Hello, I'm Adam, and welcome to Tales from the Potting Bench, a gardening podcast where you'll hear tales and stories from the most interesting and different people from the world of both indoor and outdoor gardening. This episode is sponsored by the wonderful people at Plant Grow, producers of award-winning organic fertilisers made with zero chemicals. Great for your garden and even greater for the planet. And don't forget, if you use the code POTTINGBENCH on plantgrow.co.uk, you'll get 10% off your order. Before we get into this week's episode, I'd like to ask, if you listen to this podcast and enjoy it, then please consider rating and leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice. It's easy to do, takes a few minutes of your time, but it helps this podcast get into the ears of more like-minded planty people. This episode features a conversation with gardener, writer, broadcaster and author, the sensational Alice Vincent. Alice began her career with music journalism before making a gear shift towards gardening. And in this conversation, we discuss exactly why that happened. Enjoy. So, for anyone who is not familiar with you right now, who are you and what do you do?
Hello, my name is Alice Vincent. I'm a writer who happens to garden. And I've been a career journalist for about 15 years, traditionally writing about music and the arts. And about 10 years ago, started writing about the fact I was gardening on a balcony. And I guess I'm now probably better known for writing about gardening than I am about music. But I'm the author of a few books. The most recent is Why Women Grow, and previous to that was Root Bound. And I'm really interested in the intersections of life and cities and how gardening creeps in through the sides when we're least expecting it. So yeah, that's about it.
I think I listened to you on a podcast a while ago. Forgive me, I can't remember which one it was. But you described, because you live in London now, but you're not from London. You're from what you rather amazingly call the rural donut around Milton Keynes. I loved that turn of phrase. So how did that kind of life in and around Milton Keynes turn into a life in London and journalism? Or is that what took you to London?
It is what took me there. Yeah, I didn't really want to live here. I studied in Newcastle. Which I grew up in a village that was so small that Newcastle felt like this bustling metropolis, which it is. It's an incredible city, but it's not a large one. And it felt enormous. I'd never really lived anywhere that actually had street lamps before. After that, I moved to, and I'd wanted to be a journalist since about 15, 16, and a music journalist specifically. And I lived in New York for a bit after I graduated. And then really I had to accept reality and try and find a job. So I came to London. And I guess 13 years later, I'm here still. I suppose I've always been interested in writing, and I've always been interested in asking questions and finding things out. And that's the way I process the world. So that's sort of my route into gardening as well. I'm not formally horticulturally trained. I am a communicator. And so I think that's where that intersection comes, which is that, like, when I first was given a kind of the challenge of having an urban gardening column, when I barely knew what a perennial was, frankly, I went and interviewed stallholders at Columbia Road Flower Market, for instance, which they did not take lightly to, they did not enjoy. But I guess my approach was, how do I go and talk to people who are doing things that I don't understand? And that's sort of been the thing that I'm interested in, whatever the subject, but specifically with gardening, because especially with when I was researching my most recent book, Why Women Grow, I was talking to women about why they gardened and what gardening was to them. And that was just far more fascinating than I ever could have imagined.
So journalism is your kind of bread and butter of whatever you've done kind of throughout your career, very heavily into music. So what was the thing that, because it's such a, I suppose, a gear shift from music to gardening. It almost couldn't be any more the opposite, could it?
Right, absolutely. And for a while in my mid-20s, I was living this kind of double life whereby I had this gardening column mostly online for Telegraph, occasionally in print. And I'd set up Norticulture, which is my Instagram account. And the reason why Norticulture is called Norticulture and not Alice Vincent is because I felt really bashful about it. I didn't really want to associate my name with it. I didn't really want it to be Googleable. It was a real kind of like a sort of weird horticultural alter ego, I suppose. And yeah, so why the gear shift? Yeah, you're right. It did exist in two different planes. And I remember going and meeting with like music PRs at fancy awards dues and stuff, and then finding out I had a book, which at the time was How to Grow Stuff, which was my first book, very practical guide about things that I'd grown on my balcony. And they were kind of really surprised. And then similarly, people who knew me from a garden perspective were really surprised that I was like backstage at Glastonbury. Do you know what I mean? They are totally different realms. But it changed because when around the same time, when I was in my mid-20s, I was living a life that theoretically looked very good on paper, but in reality wasn't very satisfying. So I was in what I thought was quite a stable relationship. I lived in a flat in South London, in Camberwell. I had this like glamorous seeming job, but kind of behind the scenes, it was all falling apart and it did all implode sort of catastrophically, all at the same time, in the sort of way that happens in your late 20s, right? Like it's a sickle twist situation, but I ended up really without a stable place to live, completely brokenhearted out of the blue, questioning like this career I'd worked for a really long time. And the one thing over the course of the year that followed that managed to ground me and give me hope and give me a sense of perspective and give me something that I was just completely compelled by was gardening. And when I say gardening, I mean a sort of all-encompassing sensory appreciation of growing things. So that's like the window boxes on the council estate where I lived, or volunteering at the community garden, because I was fascinated with gardening, but I didn't even have a garden of my own. I barely had a bed to sleep in. So it was observing the way that nature broke through the cracks in the pavement, quite literally. And that kind of gave me a new understanding of resilience and also where we exist as humans in all of it and how I wanted to live my life.
Well, how do I follow that? Good Lord. I think there is something that you said there that really kind of chimes with me and the way that you write. And it's funny because you started with quite a small instructional book, but you almost, and I kind of noticed in this in other conversations that you've had, and you've kind of said it now as well, you almost talk about Rootbound though as your first book, because correct. It's almost as though it's a separate kind of entity because it's doing something different, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah, that's really well observed. How to Grow Stuff is sort of a kind of funny adopted baby, I think. Like it's, I'm really grateful for the opportunity of writing it. But I remember even when I submitted that manuscript, there were a whole swathe, not whole swathes, but paragraphs here and there that were cut out that would eventually end up in Rootbound that I wanted to make it more personal, because I've never proclaimed to be a gardening expert. I'm never, you know, if you want to know how to properly prune your roses or, you know, what to do with your lawn, there are so many people who are far more qualified than me, and I'd be the first to admit it. But what I do have is a certain understanding of how we live alongside gardens and what we need them for. And that was something that I started to explore in Rootbound and kind of passed the mic over for Why Women Grow. And that's the kind of the realm that I'm much more interested in, which is how do we navigate who we are as people via our gardens?
Yeah.
And those green spaces around us.
It's more, I suppose, for anyone that hasn't seen either of them, they sit together, but they're completely different books in a way. But they're not what you expect from a quote-unquote gardening book. And I spoke to Andrew O'Brien not that long ago, and I kind of, whether either of you agree with this, I'm sure you probably will, but I kind of put you in similar categories in the way that you write, in that it's not instructional, it's kind of more it's like narrative nonfiction, isn't it, really? I suppose is what you would kind of class it as. And Rootbound, which I've got here, which I've actually got a proof copy of, which is a really, really gorgeous book. This kind of touches on so much, but there were real kind of elements of upbringing and family, and you talk about your grandmother in here as well, which was something that really struck a chord with me. And there was a similarity that absolutely struck a chord with me, that I think there's this thing that you go through your childhood completely unaware of what you're picking up subconsciously, until you then at some point it comes back to haunt you, not necessarily in a bad way, as an adult, that you just weren't aware of what you were absorbing. And you talk about your grandmother in a similar way to the way that I kind of felt growing up as well, and realizing that was happening around me, but then not aware of it until I was older. Is that how you felt as well?
Yeah, it's sort of exactly what you're saying. Like it very much creeps up on you until you're at a point when you feel you needed it. I think I'd had a sort of craving to understand who my grandparents were for quite a long time, because they weren't around for very long when I was little. By the time I was I was in my late teens when my last grandparent died, but the majority of them had died by the time I was sort of barely a teenager. And I was curious about who these people were, who I heard a lot about. And I had explored that in other creative practices before. But I think also that when this sort of, you know, to answer your previous question of like, why gardening? How did that happen? I was just as bemused as everyone else. And so was a lot of people in my family. Did you just hear the baby?
Yeah.
He's hanging out his first podcast recording. He's like really keen to make everyone aware that he's here.
Need to let him know about this when he's older. This is his first podcast.
He's like, you're talking about family. Do you want to mention me? but yeah, I had this real sense of like, who's responsible for this? I did actually grow up with ready access and very easily won access to land. And that's something that I go on to interrogate in Why Women Grow. But until I did that, I just sort of assumed that my grandfathers and my grandmother were kind of involved in that. And I don't actually think they were, but I think it was a kind of desire for understanding stuff that makes you. Because when you're looking at plants and you're thinking about roots, it's natural to look at the ones that you associate with yourself in a more human way. And plants is a way to do that. And what's interesting is when I have been interviewing, you know, even before I started interviewing for Why Women Grow, you speak to sort of anyone about gardening or people come talk to you about it. The number of times when they'll say, oh, well, my mum was really into this, or my grandmother loved this, or my grandfather did this. You know, I'm not saying for everyone, because I know of people who have come to the land and it's been a very, very difficult journey for them.
Mm-hmm.
But in lots of cases, people are taught how to garden by their ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we carry with us.
This is really occurring to me now. Could this have easily have been something else? Could this have easily have not been gardening? Could you have turned to something else?
Perhaps. I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think there's a unique combination of things that gardening offers that really makes it unlike other things in my life. So I'm a bit of a control freak, put it lightly, and I really like being, I guess, something of a master of my own destiny to a certain extent. And obviously gardening increasingly is a climate catastrophe. That's impossible. So I sort of relish and really appreciate living with that uncertainty of gardening. Like, will it, won't it? That, you know, we go through these seasonal cycles and we think we know what to expect, but actually every year we're taking a gamble on what will this year be. And you start out at this sort of time of year. I mean, this is the end of May now, like Chelsea is happening. We're right at this moment of great positivity. And you think, this will be the year that I'll get this to germinate, or this will look amazing. And you stand there and you picture what your growing space will look like in your mind's eye. And then, you know, you can fast forward 5 months and you're doing the reverse. You're looking back and you're like, well, that didn't work. Or maybe next year I'll try that. Every year we go through these huge cycles of kind of hope and realism and learning. And I'm not sure that there would be any other process in my life that I could apply to that. Because it's so reliant on things that are bigger than ourselves.
100%. Root Band is an amazing book. It really genuinely is. Why Women Grow is also fantastic, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But there's just something about Root Band that is finding yourself, which is a really obvious thing to say, but finding yourself during a really difficult period and something that is just getting you through, which I think, going back, because this was January 2020? Mm-hmm. Which was pre-pandemic.
It was 6 weeks before. Yeah, the book came out the 30th of January, so 6 weeks before we locked down.
Which is quite odd, really, isn't it? Because I feel as though it'll do, because it came out before lockdown and kind of before a time that we didn't know that we were going to go into this period of real uncertainty. And I really think that we forget how uncertain that, in particular, that first lockdown was. It was never ending at that point. There was no end in sight at all. I mean, that's sensationalising it slightly, but we just did not know when we were coming out of that first lockdown. I think this book does something. It's almost as though it needs a reissue or something. Do you know what I mean? Or some sort of
you're going to have a word with my publisher about
I will.
That.
I will. Absolutely will.
But no, it's an interesting point you make, because, like, yes, it came out 6 weeks before the pandemic. I had this huge, very boozy, probably super spreader event launch and a real last hurrah. And then I remember, and you know, the book came out and it was in lots of shop windows and it was all kind of exciting. And I remember then all the shops shutting and Root Band was kind of stuck in the window of like Foyles and Charing Cross Road and other places. Just sort of, you still see some spines, hardback spines particularly, in certain bookshops and they're faded, or people have very faded copies, and you're like, that was probably just sun drenched by this very beautiful spring. Mm. And it was a really odd feeling, Adam, because on one level, here was a book that was talking about how we turn to the ground in times of uncertainty and trauma, at a time when everyone is going through uncertainty and trauma and gardening in their droves. And on the other hand, it's like, in many ways, the first serious literary book. And it's just been ossified, and all of my events are cancelled, and all of my speaking commitments are cancelled, and pieces I'd written for colour supplements were spiked because they were no longer relevant, apparently. You know, like all of this, it felt like such a limp balloon, while at the same time kind of exploring things that we were all experiencing. So that was a really odd combination of things going on. And I think it's really, it's amazing. I mean, I never thought about reissue. I'm not sure it would work in a post-pandemic time, because it would somehow be too... It would tell us all what we knew already, I think.
Knew already, yeah.
Yeah.
It was ahead of its time in some sort of bizarre way, I suppose, wasn't it?
Perhaps.
There was another thing that you did as well, which you can, if you were to purely look at the books that are kind of published, you would almost miss out on, which was Seeds from Scratch.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little
that
bit about that?
That was a lockdown baby.
Well, that was, because that was an audio book, right?
Yeah, I wrote it and recorded it in lockdown in the treehouse, which, if you follow me on Instagram or it's mentioned in Why We Wanna Go, is a one bedroom flat, council flat, next to the woods in South London. And it's very unprepossessing from the outside. And then once you walk in through the door, the only thing you can see is a mature oak tree, hence treehouse. And this is a place that, spoiler alert, after the uncertainty of Rootbound, I finally find some ground of my own. And it has a balcony that's double the size of the one I previously had. And it becomes a real, really important place for me. But that is where I spent lockdown. It was there that I wrote and recorded an audiobook called Seeds from Scratch, which will talk you through the process of sowing and then growing a plant from seed over the course of 90 minutes. And you can kind of stop and start it depending on how your plants are growing. And that was a fun project. It was very delirious. I remember it was when it was really hot. And once we'd done the deal, my publisher sent like couriered round ice cream, which my partner was really excited about. He likes ice cream, and it was a really hot day, and it was just like, oh my god, amazing, magical ice cream on the doorstep. It was like, you know, there wasn't much excitement in lockdown, was there? So this was a big deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was Seeds from Scratch. That was a fun experiment, not least because I had to make a kind of duvet fort to get the audio levels right
to record,
and we were like, oh my god, are they going to mow the lawn? And there were so many birds living in the vicinity of treehouse that it was like, you never know if one of those Richmond parakeets is going to turn up and just walk the entire way through. By some miracle, they did not.
So that was a real kind of lockdown baby for you, I suppose, wasn't it? But how was lockdown for you, kind of having released all of the stuff that we've said about Rootbound and obviously all of the promotional work for that kind of essentially had gone out the window, really. What was the rest of that period like for you with your newfound gardening world? Did you love it? Yeah. Did you hate it? Was it?
I had a far nicer time than I think we admitted in the moment. Like a lot of people, I think, I mean, don't get me wrong, it was horrific for an awful lot of people. And I was not a care worker. I was not a key worker. I had the privilege and luxury of like working from home. I wasn't furloughed. I didn't lose my job. So, you know, in many ways, we're really fortunate. But all of that, it was a funny mix. So on one hand, I was like quite sad about what was happening to Rootbound. And I also felt myself in a great creative funk. But on the flip side, my partner and I were like, we'd not lived together before, and he'd moved in about 2 weeks before lockdown, theoretically on a temporary basis. Obviously, that did not happen. and we ended up getting engaged like 6 weeks in, and I remember the whole thing as being vaguely golden, like the flat faced west. So we got all of the like late afternoon sunshine coming in. The balcony door was always open. Potted around, went in the woods. Ate nice food. Like it was a funny time. And then in the summer, I started feeling this real kind of creative itch and what I later recognized as loneliness. And it was out of those things that Why Women Grow was born.
Where along that kind of lockdown window or pandemic window did that begin? And was that written during lockdown? Was that were we out of the cycle of lockdowns by the time you'd started to write that?
No, we weren't. It went on for such a long time, didn't it? So the scenes I describe in the introduction, which is like pulling out this green notebook and writing down the list of names, that was in around July of the lockdown year of 2020. And then I started researching it, doing like initial research and putting a proposal together over the autumn. So that was again between lockdowns, like when we could travel. Then in the kind of third lockdown, that wintry one of 2021, we sold the book and I started writing in earnest. And so all of the approaches I made to the women and like kind of setting up dates, going interview them and stuff, because it was incredibly important to me that we did this in person in the spaces that they chose to talk about, was kind of hodged and codged between lockdowns. And I remember getting on a train in March to Leeds. I remember doing that. And it was like the first train I'd taken in like a year. And it felt completely bizarre. And it felt like I was sort of breaking a rule or something. But, I mean, I was doing it on work purposes, so it was allowed. But it was very much a book that was created by and during lockdown. And I did, when the editing process, I did go through and take out a lot of the pandemic references. Because, you know, the pandemic is still raging, even if everyone's kind of chosen to forget about it. But we have psychologically moved on a little bit from lockdown. And I didn't want the book to be this sort of relic of a time that we didn't feel we existed anymore.
Yeah, no, of course. What was the reasoning for the wanting to do it in their kind of own space? Was that a comfort for them kind of thing? Or was it something else?
Well, it was always going to be a book about gardening, right? So, and it ended up being a book about womanhood. But you can't write, and this is the same when I'm writing journalism or whatever, I don't like to write about garden without physically being there.
Yeah.
And so that was just a practical thing. It was like, if I'm going to do this, then we have to do it in your space. Like, there's so much more about that a space can tell you about a person, and there's so much more that you can understand from meeting a person in real life, so to speak. But what it evolved into was something quite powerful, which was especially in a lockdown context when people weren't really exactly like popping around each other's houses loads, is it taught me that the power and the intimacy of outdoor spaces that I just hadn't understood before. That, and you know, sometimes these were private gardens, but I think I worked it out when I was doing a talk before, in the wake of the book coming out, which is that something like 40% of the people I spoke to chose spaces that they had either rented or they were shared or were communal, or, you know, that a good chunk were not owned private gardens, shall we say. So that was interesting in itself. And yeah, so in the context of lockdown, there's a politeness and a domesticity that happens when you cross over the threshold of somebody's house. Like, if we were doing this in person, I'd make you a cup of tea, I'd sit you down on the kitchen table, you'd ask if you need to take your shoes off, all of that stuff. That doesn't happen in someone's garden, especially when, like, you're not sure if you're going to give someone COVID if you make them a cup of tea or not. So what would happen is, like, I would turn up on a stranger's doorstep or at a park or a car park or something, and we would set about being in this space without any of the niceties, and that cuts through any small talk. I don't think gardeners do small talk much anyway, for what it's worth, but then especially in that context, you don't get into like, oh, and was the A3 clogged up, or do you know what I mean? None of that happens. You just get straight into what a space is and how it looks and what it means. And it taught me that these outdoor spaces hold so much.
With that, you must have gone to I know you did, because I've read the book, but for anyone that hasn't read the book, you've been to some varied places, as that's kind of putting it lightly. Are there any particular one? This is like saying choosing your favourite baby or child, isn't it? Which I'm not going to do, but are there any in particular that really stood out to you for one reason or another?
I'm going to talk to you about the ones that are coming to mind immediately, because that's the only way I can answer this question. The first one was on the 29th floor of a very glossy block of flats in Canary Wharf that was rented by a 25-year-old, I think she was a finance analyst or consultant, named Fernanda. And Fernanda had moved around a lot. She was originally from Hong Kong. She'd lived in America. She'd lived in Germany. I think she lived in Denmark. And she'd only been in this flat for kind of maybe 9 months, a year. And then at the end of the year, she was moving out to go to Edinburgh.
Right.
So she was in this really, that kind of, when you're in your early 20s, a very accelerated kind of nomadism, I suppose. And her balcony in this sea of, like, I've never seen, I don't spend much time in Canary Wharf anyway, but I've certainly never seen it from that angle, which is like high up in a domestic space, kind of, it's all glass and light and grey and sort of this weird kind of 80s future realism.
Mm.
And yet her balcony was just bursting to life, and she had lots of kind of scrappy pots and, you know, a bit of kind of coriander here and a sweet pea here, and in the corner there was a kind of tiny composter, and she was trying to grow some mushrooms, and like, it was a real suck it and see, have a go, but it was so living and so beautiful as a result, because of she was growing out sheer determination. You know, if you read any book that was like how to grow edibles in pots, you would absolutely not do it that way.
Yeah.
And yet here she was growing everything. And that was really amazing. And then the second one that comes to mind was, and possibly because I was talking about that train, was Oakwell Park, which is up near Dewsbury. And that was the day before spring solstice. And it was a grey, cold day. That spring after lockdown was miserable, but it reminded me a lot of the spring we've had here, just like didn't seem to ever get going.
Yeah.
And it was a kind of cold, grizzly day, but you could smell the wild garlic in the air, and the lichen and the moss was all like kicking into life. You could sort of sense that it was coming. And it was quite an unprepossessing place. I'm sure later in the year it's very, very beautiful, but it was sort of that proper sludgy, wintry brown and grey. But we walked all over it. We spent 2 or 3 hours walking, and you get to the top and you just get this incredible view over the dale. That was also very cool. So two very different places, one very big, one very small, one very domestic, one very shared. But yeah, everywhere I went, I've got a sort of mad picture memory of.
I bet you have. How did the decision kind of making as to who was going to feature, or which spaces were going to feature in the garden, how did that come about?
So it was quite a complex process. The short story is I sort of wrote that list, and then I wanted to broaden research, so I put out an online survey. 700 people responded. From that, it was a combination of like geographical practicality, what people had to say about their relationship with their garden, a certain level of demographic inclusivity, and you know, and who was up for doing it as well. And then when it came to the book, I suppose that's part of writing and journalism and bringing a story together. I mean, the book could have been 3 times as long, but I brought together stories that I thought dovetailed together and held their own as much as they contributed to the whole. So yeah, there was a lot of when my husband read the book, he said it was like a quilt. He didn't like it that much for what it's worth, which is fine, genuinely. But it wasn't really written for him, so it's
no.
But I've long learned that like your job as a writer is to write things, and it's not really to try and make people like them or not. Not really your work. But
it's not true then, is it? It's not a true reflection of anything of you then, if you're writing for somebody, is it?
Yeah, maybe so. I was writing this with the women in mind, definitely, but not necessarily for them. But yeah, he compared it to a quilt, and I think that is quite a beautiful way of summing up what it is. It is definitely individual stories that add up to something much greater.
I think there's something else that hopefully people are aware of, which is the podcast of the same name, which is Why Women Grow, which I absolutely love. There are so many gardening podcasts now. I say that mildly, ironically, but I think there's something about the conversations that you have. So I most recently listened to the Sarah Raven one, which kind of almost brings us full circle in a weird way, in that she came from a background that most people probably don't know, in that she used to be a doctor. I don't think that's necessarily widely, known.
It's not.
And then again, from, you know, being a doctor, hospital ward, kind of 80 hours a week, I think she said she was doing at one point, to then suddenly having a cut flower book, which is, it was very kind of sudden that her husband sold the idea at a wedding, I think it was, wasn't it? And then, but for that kind of juxtaposition between original career and then kind of what she's doing now, and the way that you've kind of done similar, haven't you? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to compare myself to Sarah. She's an absolute titan. But yes, I think what's so interesting about her approach, and I remember her talking about this when I went to a press day there years ago, and she was like, I'm a medic, I'm a scientist, and I try all my flowers with that approach. And like, I am, personally speaking, like, there are certain elements of my life which are complete chaos energy. I've been like fobbing off emails from my accountant like all week. So, you know, there are certain things where, and actually I'm a really slapdash gardener as well. And I feel like and a slapdash cook, but ultimately the result is hopefully satisfactory in some way. I'm quite messy in a lot of the processes of my life, but I think there are certain elements of gardening where precision is rewarded. Sarah's approach comes from this really beautiful marrying of scientific kind of accuracy and a complete thirst and love for creativity and beauty and colour. And she did change the colours in our the colours that we grow in our garden. I firmly believe that. But yeah, with the podcast, is it's an understandable confusion because they have the same name, but it's not the women who I interviewed for the book.
No.
And that is because the women I spoke to in the book, I granted them a certain amount of anonymity because a lot of the subjects they talk about are deeply personal. And they kind of were so generous in letting me into their lives. Whereas obviously on a podcast, you can't do that in quite the same way. And instead, what I wanted to do, I'd filed the manuscript. I remember this so clearly. I was stood on the beach and down in like West Sussex waiting for the ice cream queue, and I just fired an email off to my agent being like, do you think there should be a podcast of this? Because I knew there were more stories, and I also knew how much I'd gained from having a conversation, and I was very aware that I could never capture the physical sound and tete-a-tete, I suppose, of those conversations. And so I was like, okay, we'll do the podcast, but we'll do it with people that obviously are well known and but also perhaps not known for gardening or not known for their life around gardening. So Sarah is probably the most horticultural of the lot. We also spoke to fashion designer Margaret Howell, Paula Sutton, who runs Hill House Vintage, the wildly successful Instagram account, Claire Ratanen, who's an author and grower, Poppy Okocha, who's an environmentalist, Sally Vickers, who's a novelist, and Rukmini Iyer, who writes the Roastington book. And all of them... It was such a joy to do, Adam, because like, I am a complete podcast rookie. I'm heavily reliant on my producer, Holly. We really went and, you know, photographer Siobhan came along as well, and we kind of set out across the course of what was meant to be maybe 6 weeks of recording, and we strung it into 5 months. And over the course, and like kind of bundling in the back of like hired VW Golfs and stuff, just like setting off across the country. And we started as sort of three acquaintances, and it was a weird summer for all of us. All of us were going through quite mad personal stuff at the same time. And I feel like we catch up every few weeks and travel across the country and record these podcasts and have these amazing conversations. So it's a project that I know all three of us feel very deeply about.
Good. Will there be more then?
I really hope so. It's honestly, it comes down to finding a partner. So we need the money to fund it. It's expensive to record on location. And
yeah,
I have an all-female team. The artwork, the music, everything is done by women. We even recorded in a feminist recording studio for the bits that weren't done in location. And I really want to pay everyone fairly. So it comes down to the money. But, you know, if the stars align, hopefully.
I hope so too, because it's fantastic. You. For anyone that is not aware of all of these various things that we've talked about, I'll put the link to everything in the show notes for everyone to have a look. So it's come to the time where I've got three questions that I pose to every guest on the podcast. Are you ready?
Yeah,
as you'll ever be. Brilliant. Okay, so question number one. If you were stuck on a desert island with only one other gardener, who would it be and why?
You know what? I'd probably choose... I'm going to disappoint you. It's not going to be a famous person.
That's totally fine.
I'm going to choose Maya Thomas, who's a good friend, and she's actually interviewed in Why Women Grow as well. She's a fantastic gardener, but she's also a very, very good chef, and she's a herbologist. So I'm like, that's a triple threat, right?
Yeah.
She can help me garden things, but she can cook them. And also she has this incredible encyclopedic knowledge about herbs. So if any, when I inevitably get into a scrape, because as mentioned, I'm clumsy, she can like whip up a tincture,
nice.
You know,
yeah.
Maybe have a delicious like herbal cocktail.
Cocktail, yeah. That's where my mind went. As soon as you said herbologist, I went cocktail.
Right, exactly. Or everything you need. So that's who I'd vote for. And if you want to follow Maya's work, she runs The Modern Herbal, which is this really amazing platform doing very cool stuff. And you can find that on Instagram.
Exciting. I shall seek her out. Second question. If you could never garden again, horrible prospect, I know. What would you spend your time doing instead?
I'd probably try and do something that's as close to gardening that isn't gardening. So I'm guessing that's like doing anything on the land is probably forbidden. But I've got very into, I think I'd probably swim. You know full well that we had to move this podcast recording because I went for my first cold water swim since the baby turned up. So that was this morning, and I started about a year ago, and I've got really addicted to it. And I think there's a lot about swimming, cold water swimming especially, that has similar connection to what gardening gives me. It's a like beautiful mixture of like uncertainty and giving yourself over and surrender and persistence and exposure to the elements that I find gratifying.
Amazing. Cold swimming. I think somebody else on the podcast has mentioned cold swimming. I'm not sure it's advisable in the waters of the Midlands, so perhaps I'll find somewhere else. And if you picture your garden now, if you had to flee your garden right now, which one thing or plant would you take with you to a new garden?
It's a really good question, because over the last 3 weeks, the garden has been re-landscaped. And so I've already been in a situation where I've been trying to save the things that I love, because, for a while, it was literally just several tons of earth in a giant mound in the middle of it. And so, yeah, that's what I've been thinking about. So the thing I would say is a plant that actually I planted as a bare root this year, and I'm putting a lot of hope in it, but it's a Mary Delaney rose. And I bought that rose upon finishing and submitting the manuscript for Why Women Grow. And Mary Delaney is written about in the opening chapters. She was this like really rad 18th century aristocrat and author and artist and landscape gardener who, just kind of really quietly but in quite a potent way bucked a load of the expectations out of her. So yeah, we'd maybe take the Mary Delaney rose, but it's quite an easy question at the moment because I'm down to a real skeleton of plants anyway.
If I ask you at a different time, it's probably a different answer.
And if it'll change with the weather, absolutely.
Alice's latest book, Why Women Grow, is out now from Canongate Books, and it's available in all good bookshops and online. You can find Alice on Instagram at Nauticulture or on Twitter at Alice_Emily. This is technically the last episode of the current season, but join me again very soon for a couple of bonus episodes with people from some companies that I think you'll enjoy as much as I do, but more on that soon. Until then, you can follow me on Instagram at viewfromthepottingbench to see what I'm up to in my garden, or visit viewfromthepottingbench.com to read my blog and much more.